There were orange trees in the conservatory at Hartford House, wrought on under glass against all the scents of the season, and it was their scent, sweet, insistent, with something faintly rotten underneath it, that Rowena Fitch would carry with her afterward through 2 years and a great many miles, as the smell of the night her life divided itself in two. She had gone looking for the man she was to marry because supper was to be called, and a betrothed woman ought to be on her promised husband's arm when it was. She did not find what she had gone to find. She found Marcus Bramwell, Duke of Larchmont, with his back half turned and his hand at the waist of a woman in pale gold silk. And she knew the silk, and she knew the set of the shoulders, and she knew, before the woman turned her face into the low light, that it was her own sister. It was not a misunderstanding. Rowena had spent a great deal of her life being told she imagined slights where none existed, and had trained herself to require proof before believing a hard thing. She had her proof. There was no innocent arrangement of two bodies that placed them as these two were placed, no version of the moment that survived a second look. Selina's eyes came open and found her sister across the warm dark of the glass house, and in them was not shame, exactly, but a kind of bracing, the look of a woman preparing the account she would give. Rowena did not wait to hear it. She stepped back through the door before the Duke had registered that the air had changed and walked toward the noise of the ballroom with her spine very straight and her face arranged, and behind her the orange trees went on giving off their false and lovely scent in the November cold. She could never fully explain what she did then, except that she had only one thing left that was wholly hers, her composure, and she would not surrender it in that house. She returned to the ballroom, and she danced, a country dance with her own father, who beamed and called her his steady girl, and never saw a thing. The last waltz with old Lord Pelham, who told her she would make the Duke a fine duchess. When the candles guttered and the carriages were called, she went to every guest of consequence and wished them a good night and a safe road, and they went away saying what a composed creature she was. She did not weep. She had decided, somewhere between the conservatory and the ballroom, that no one in that house would have her tears as well as everything else. She was gone before the household woke. She left no note, because a note is a thing that can be answered, and she did not wish to be answered. She took the clothes she could carry in a single case, the little money she had put by over years of careful management, her mother's prayer book, and a small carved locket worth nothing to anyone but her. And she walked out of her father's house into the gray before dawn and bought passage to the largest city she could afford to reach, because a large city is a place where a woman may be no one at all. And being no one at all was, just then, the only thing she wanted to be. She did not yet know that she carried, under her traveling cloak, the one part of that night she would never be able to leave behind, and would never wish to. To understand why she ran, for it was running, and she never pretended to herself it was anything finer, one must understand her life before it. Rowena was the eldest of the Fitch daughters. Her mother had died when she was 17, and from that day the running of the household had fallen to her as naturally as water finds its level. Their father, Mr. Walter Fitch, was a kind man and a weak one, who loved his daughters and could not manage them, and had let the family's reputation slide toward ruin until Rowena took the account books out of his hands and set the house in order. She had kept them respectable on very little, turned worn gowns 3 times so that no one guessed how worn they were, and become, by 23, the sort of woman of whom people said admiringly that she was so very capable, which is the thing said of women whom no one troubles to ask what they themselves might want. And Selina had become the sort of woman about whom no such thing was ever said. She was lovely in the bright, immediate way that rooms forgive everything for, and had learned young that what Rowena built, Selina might take, and the taking be excused. A ribbon, a suitor, the better bedchamber. It had always been so, all their lives. And Rowena had told herself it was the privilege of the prettier sister and the duty of the elder, and had given things up smiling, because giving things up smiling was what she was for. She had never imagined the list of takeable things would come to include the man she was to marry. The agony of that conservatory was not the Duke at all. It was that her own sister, in her own father's house, on the one night of Rowena's life meant to be hers, had taken the single thing Rowena had let herself believe was not Selina's to take. For she had not loved him. Not yet, not exactly. She had agreed to the match because it was a good one, and because Marcus Bramwell, on the few occasions they had spoken at length, had treated her as a person with a working mind rather than an ornament with a dowry, and she had thought there might be in it the makings of something honest. But she had been willing to be in love, and willingness, it turned out, could be broken every bit as cleanly as love. To stay would have required her to perform a forgiveness she did not feel in front of the people who would expect it of her every day for the rest of her life, and Rowena Fitch had never in her life been able to perform what she did not mean. So she did not stay to perform it. She went. She discovered she was with child 3 weeks later in a narrow rented room above a chandler's, and she sat very still for a long time with her hand pressed flat against herself, and then did what she had always done, which was to take the account of her situation honestly and decide what must be managed. She would not go back. That was the first and fixed point, and everything else arranged itself around it. She had a little money and a great deal of competence and a name she could not safely use, and so she invented a plainer one and a dead husband to go with it, a young officer conveniently lost at sea, a story that asked few questions because it answered the only one that mattered. And after a hard winter she did not afterward like to remember, she found respectable work in the household of Mrs. Peel. Mrs. Peel was the widow of a clergyman, comfortable without being grand, settled in a market town 2 days' ride from anywhere a duke might be expected to go, and she wanted a companion, a gentlewoman, to read to her and write her letters and bear the small tyrannies of the lonely old, at which Rowena was by then very practiced. She came as Mrs. Rowena Carr, widow, with an infant son, and Mrs. Peel, who was sharper than she let people see and kinder than she let people guess, looked at the steady young woman and the dark-eyed baby and the careful invented history, and asked exactly no questions she had not been invited to ask. "You will suit me," she said, "if you can abide an old woman's complaints and read aloud without rushing the good parts. The child may stay. The house has been too quiet without the noise of one." And so Rowena stayed, and the house was not quiet, and the boy grew. She called him Walter, after her father, because even now she could not bring herself to cut every thread that tied her to the people she had left, and her father had done nothing but be weak, which is not the same as cruel. Walter Carr, for so the town knew him, was a serious infant who became a watchful, sturdy little boy, dark-eyed and slow to laugh, and then, when he laughed, helpless with it. He had a carved wooden horse that the town's joiner had made him out of an offcut of oak, rubbed smooth and given a mane scored in with a knife, and he carried it everywhere and slept with it under his cheek and named it, with the literal solemnity of the very young, horse. He had, Rowena knew, his father's eyes, that particular gray that was nearly green in strong light, and she was aware of it every single day, and said nothing, and folded the knowledge away with all the rest. She did not know how the Duke of Larchmont had spent those same 2 years. She did not know that he had dismissed her sister from his life on the morning after the engagement ball, in a brief cold interview from which they had never afterward exchanged a word, that he had ridden to her father's house 3 days later to find his betrothed already gone, and had stood in the hall and understood, with a completeness that left him unable to speak, exactly what he had thrown away and why. The Duke was not a man who excused himself. What had happened in the conservatory had been his doing as much as Selina's. He had been proud and a little drunk on the certainty of his own consequence, and a woman who had pursued him for half a year had been there in the warm dark, and he had not refused her, and there was no version of it in which he was not contemptible. He held that knowledge without flinching, because flinching seemed to him the last cowardice available. So he looked for her, with the methodical patience of a man doing penance, for 2 years, and did not find her, because a competent woman who has decided not to be found is very difficult to find. His obligations in the House of Lords called him to town through 2 long sessions, and he attended to them grimly and went on looking in between. Her family believed what Selina had given them to believe, that Rowena had taken fright at so great a match, and fled foolishly as overwrought girls were held to do, and that it was all very sad and best not spoken of. Selina had said nothing of the conservatory. She had spent 2 years arranging her face into the expression of the wronged and bewildered sister, and had been very generally pitied for it. It was a lie with a second lie folded inside it, and the Duke knew its shape and could prove nothing, and so said nothing, and the silence sat in him like a stone. He found her, or rather, the world found her for him, which was not at all the same thing, and which mattered enormously, On a wet afternoon in the spring of the third year, at a subscription concert in a market town he had no business being in, except that a dying friend kept a house nearby, and the friend's wife had insisted he be got out of the sick room for an evening and sent him, half against his will, to the town's little concert. He stood at the back of a crowded, candlelit room, not thinking of Rowena Fitch, for he had at last begun to school himself out of thinking of her at every hour. And then a woman three rows from the front turned her head to quiet a fretful child beside an old lady, and he saw her face, and the floor of the world went out from under him. He did not move. He did not call out, did not stride down the room and make of her a public spectacle a second time. He had done that to her once already in a conservatory with her sister, and he understood with sudden violent clarity that whatever he did now must above all not be a thing done to her. So he held himself motionless with an effort that left him shaking, in exactly the way she had once stood still in a ballroom and danced every dance while her heart came apart, though he did not know it. And then the child slid down from the bench and toddled into the aisle on the determined business of the very young, a small, dark boy of perhaps 18 months with a carved wooden horse gripped in one fist, and Rowena rose and caught him up before he could escape, and as she lifted him, the boy turned his face out toward the room, laughing, and the Duke of Larchmont looked into a child's eyes that were his own gray going green in the candlelight, and understood everything there was to understand, in public, in silence, in the space between one note of the music and the next. He did not approach her that night. He left before the interval and sat up until morning with his head in his hands. The next day he made his inquiries with care, learned the name she went by and the household she served, and then did the single hardest thing he had ever done, which was to send word ahead like a civilized man and ask whether Mrs. Carr would receive a caller rather than present himself at her door with the brute fact of himself. He had no claim, and knew it. So he came as a man with nothing to offer but the truth and the willingness to be judged by it, and let her decide whether he might come at all. She received him because she was not a coward either, and because she had known, from the moment she felt his eyes on her in the assembly rooms, that this was no longer a thing she could outrun. She received him in Mrs. Peel's small parlor, with the rain on the windows and her hands folded in her lap and her plain gray companion's gown buttoned to the throat. And how strange it was, she thought, to sit before him so, when the last time he had seen her clearly, she had been in silk with her mother's pearls at her neck. She had Walter taken upstairs first. Whatever this conversation was to be, the boy would not be in the room for it until she chose. The Duke came in travel-worn and gray at the temples in a way he had not been, and he did not sit until she bade him. And when she bade him, he sat on the very edge of the chair like a man who did not expect to be allowed to stay. "I will not insult you," he said, "by pretending I have come for any reason but the one you already know." His voice was low and level, and without the easy remoteness she remembered, the quality she had once mistaken for distinction, and now understood, had only been a man's distance from his own life. "I saw you. I saw the child. I've spent 2 years looking for you, and I want you to understand that I did not find you. Chance found you and handed you to me, and I have no more right to you tonight than I had the morning you left. I have come to say what I should have been able to say 2 years ago and was not, and then I will do whatever you tell me to do, including go and not come back, if that is what you tell me." Rowena looked at him for a long moment. "Say it, then," she said. So he said it. He told her plainly, without softening a single edge, what had happened in the conservatory and that it had been his doing, and his shame, and no fault of hers, that he had ended things with Selina the morning after and not spoken to her since, that her family believed she had fled out of folly because Selina had let them, and that he had been unable to correct the lie without proof, and had carried his silence like a sickness. He did not weep, though his voice was not steady. He laid the whole account before her the way an honest steward lays accounts before a master, nothing hidden. And when he had finished, he stopped and waited, and let her judge. "You did not know," Rowena said at last, "about him." "It was not a question." "No. I took some care that you should not." She held his eyes. "I want that understood between us before another word. I did not keep him from you to punish you. I kept him, because he was mine to keep, because in the hour I knew of him, I had nothing in the world that was certainly mine except him, and I would not give the deciding of his life to a house that had already taught me what it thought I was worth. That was my choice to make. It was the only choice that was entirely mine in 2 years of choices, and I made it, and I do not repent of it, and I will not have you grieve at me as though I robbed you. You cannot be robbed of what you did not know to want. Her voice steadied. His name is Walter. He is 1 year and 7 months old. He is serious and stubborn and dear, and he has wanted for nothing I could give him, and I could give him a great deal more than the people who called me capable ever troubled to imagine. I tell you this so you do not mistake him for something you have found. He is not a thing. He is a person. He has been here the whole time. I know it, said the Duke. I've never been so aware of anything as I am of how little I have to do with the fact that he is well and good and yours. I am glad of it, glad he had you, and only you, when he could not have anyone better. He looked down at his hands. I am not here to take him. I could not and would not, and the law be damned. I am here because you both deserve an honest accounting from the man who failed you, and because I would like, knowing I have no right to it, to be permitted to try to deserve a place near you. And if the answer is no, it is no, and I will provide for the boy in whatever manner you permit and trouble you no further. She did not answer that night, nor for 9 days. She was not cruel about it, and she was not coy. She simply would not be hurried into a thing that mattered this much, and she told him so, and he accepted it without a flicker of protest, which told her more than any speech could have. He took a room at the inn and did not press her. He asked through Mrs. Peel whether he might call again. He asked the third time whether he might meet the boy, not as anyone, only as a gentleman of Mrs. Peel's acquaintance, and Rowena, after a day's thought, allowed it. She watched the whole of that first meeting, hawk-eyed, watched the Duke of Larchmont lower himself to the parlor floor in his good coat and gravely admire a wooden horse named Horse, and be informed at length that Horse ate hay and also cake. Her son, who was slow to warm to anyone, decided within the half hour that this large, quiet man was acceptable, and she watched the man's face and saw on it nothing she had feared, no triumph, no calculation, no hunger to possess, only a careful, disbelieving tenderness held in check, as though he did not trust himself to be given so much. It moved her, and she was too honest to pretend otherwise. Before she would say what she required, she made a single condition that she understood afterward had been the most important thing she ever asked of him. "You will not spare me my reputation by silence," she said. "I have lived 2 years under my sister's version of why I vanished, and I will not begin a new life on top of that lie still standing. My father will be brought here and told what happened in that conservatory and who I am and who Walter is, and he will be told it by you, to your own discredit, in front of me. I will not say it for you." The Duke inclined his head and said that he would have it no other way, and had hoped she would ask it. Mr. Walter Fitch came to the market town a fortnight later, an old man now. The Duke had written to him first and asked whether he would come, rather than springing it upon him. He came into the small parlor and saw the daughter he had mourned as good as dead, alive and grave and lovelier than he remembered, and he made a sound that was not quite a word and crossed the room with his arms out, and Rowena, who had promised herself she would not, wept then against her father's shoulder for the first time in 2 years, because it is one thing to leave the people who failed you, and quite another to learn that one of them had loved you the whole while and simply not known how to save you. And then the Duke of Larchmont told the old man the truth. He stood in the middle of the room and told it without one word of self-excuse, naming his own conduct for exactly what it had been, and Selina's, and the lie she had let the family carry. And he watched Mr. Fitch's face go from confusion to comprehension to a grief and shame of its own without once looking away. It was, Rowena thought, the bravest thing she had seen a man do, not because it was loud or grand, for it was neither, but because it cost him everything a proud man has, paid out in front of the people whose good opinion he most wanted, with no guarantee of buying anything at all with it. When he had finished, the room was very quiet. Mr. Fitch sat down heavily and said after a while that he had been a fool and an old fool and was sorrier than he could say. Rowena went to him and took his hand and told him the truest thing she knew, that the only person in the affair who had done a deliberate wrong was not in the room. The truth went home with Mr. Fitch and did its quiet work without anyone needing to lift a hand against Selina. There was no scene, no confrontation, no reckoning paid out in shouts. There did not need to be. A lie can only stand so long as no one knows it is a lie. And once Mr. Fitch knew, Selina's careful 2-year construction of the wrong sister simply ceased to bear her weight. She was not cast out and not denounced. The Fitches were too proud and too private for that. She was only suddenly and completely known, and she found being known punishment enough and not to be born under the eyes of the family she had deceived. She removed herself within the month to a distant cousin in the far north on the pretext of the cousin's poor health and did not come back. And the visits home grew fewer and then stopped, and that was all. It was not revenge. Rowena took no satisfaction in it and sought none. She had spent her whole life giving things up to her sister and discovered she did not, after all, want the thing her sister had at last been made to give up, the regard of people who now saw her clearly. Some accounts settle themselves quietly if one only declines to keep paying into them, but all of that came after. On the afternoon of the accounting, with her father restored to her and the truth standing plain in the room at last, the Duke turned to Rowena and asked her, in front of her father, with the boy playing on the rug at their feet, whether she would let him try. "Not reclaim you," he said. "There is nothing of the old arrangement I want back. It is dead and good riddance. I'm asking for something we never had. I'm asking whether you will let me court you, slowly, on whatever terms you set, with no claim and no certainty, and whether, if I prove I can be trusted with it, you might one day let me marry you, not because it mends anything, for nothing needs mending that you have not already mended yourself, but because two people who have come to the truth between them might choose to build the honest thing they were once cheated of. You owe me no answer. You never did." Rowena let him wait. She let the silence stretch, not to torment him, but because the moment deserved to be felt to its full weight, and because she had learned, in 2 hard years, that the things she said into silence she could be sure she meant. Her father held his breath. The rain ticked at the glass. Walter, oblivious, drove his wooden horse along the edge of the hearthrug and murmured to it in the low, absorbed monologue of a small boy at serious work. "You will not lie to me," she said at last. "Not to spare me, not to spare yourself, not about small things or large ones. The one thing I cannot live beside is a lie, and you have just shown me you can tell the truth at cost, which is the only kind that counts. That is the first condition." "Agreed," said the Duke. "You will not buy him." She nodded at the boy. "He is not a prince to be groomed. He will know when he is old enough to understand it, exactly who he is and how he came to be, told honestly in my words, and he will be loved for himself and not for the blood in him. If I ever once see you prize the heir over the child, we are finished, whatever has been promised. That is the second." "Agreed." "More than agreed." "And you will be patient," she said, and her voice was not quite steady now, the only crack she would allow herself, "because I am not the willing girl who could be persuaded into something honest 2 years ago. I am harder than she was, and warier, and I do not give my trust the way I gave it then, all at once, hopefully. You will have it in pieces, slowly, or not at all, and you will not complain of the slowness, because the slowness is the price of what was broken, and you broke it. That is the last." "Agreed," said Marcus Bramwell, Duke of Larchmont, "to every word without one syllable of negotiation, now and as long as I live." And he meant it so plainly that her father, watching, let out his held breath in something like a sob. It was then that Walter, who had grown bored of his own company and had been studying the large, quiet man for some minutes, got to his feet and crossed the rug with the swaying gravity of the very young and held up to the Duke, for inspection, for approval, for whatever it is a child offers when he offers the thing he loves best, his carved wooden horse. The Duke took it as though it were the seals of an office. He turned it over in his big hands with proper ceremony, admired its mane, was told its name, and asked permission before he gave it back. And Walter, satisfied, climbed without ceremony into the man's lap and resumed his game from the new vantage. And the Duke sat very still, holding the boy without daring to tighten his arms, his face above the dark head doing something complicated and undefended. And over the child's head, he and Rowena looked at each other, and neither of them said anything, because there was nothing that needed saying that the moment had not already said. They were married in the spring of the following year, quietly, in the market town's small gray church, with Mrs. Peel weeping happily in the front pew, and Mr. Fitch giving his daughter away with a steadiness he had not had in years, and Walter, 2 and a half now and very grand in a new coat, carrying the ring on a cushion with both hands and the expression of a boy entrusted with the fate of nations. It was a real marriage this time, built the slow way, in pieces, and because it had been built that way, it held, as things flung together in haste do not. Mrs. Peel was provided for. The Duke saw to it without being asked, settling on her a comfortable independence, and she came to visit often and was treated as family, for she had been more of a family to Rowena in 2 hard years than Blood had been in 20. His people, Mrs. Loftus, who ran the great house, and Mr. Lander, who oversaw his lands, took the new Duchess in with a wariness that lasted exactly as long as it took them to discover that she knew an account book from a hole in the ground and would not be condescended to. And the truth, the whole of it, was kept ready for Walter against the day he should be old enough to be told it straight, in his mother's words, rather than crooked from someone else. The years went on and were good ones. Walter at 8 was nothing like the watchful infant his mother had carried alone through a hard first winter. He was loud and confident and forever in motion, a boy who flung himself at the world with the unguarded certainty of a child who has never for 1 hour doubted he is loved, which was the thing Rowena had wanted for him above every other and had not been sure, in that narrow room above the Chandler's, she would ever be able to give him. There was a daughter now, too, small and dark and imperious, who ruled her brother with a rod of iron and her father with a glance. The hothouse had been given over, at the Duchess's instruction, to ordinary useful things, and the orange trees someone had once forced into out-of-season bloom were let go. Rowena had no taste, she found, for flowers made to open against the season. She kept instead a real garden, things grown in their own time, overseen through a gardener and not done with her own hands, whatever the children believed, and found in its slow, honest work the same steady expansion she had known since she walked out of her father's house. The sense of being, for the first time and ever after, the author of her own days. The carved wooden horse stood on the mantelpiece in the Duke's study, the only object in that grave masculine room that did not belong there, rubbed smooth and worn pale at the saddle from a small boy's grip, long outgrown and never given away. Rowena had asked him once why he kept it there among his books and seals and the portraits of his consequential ancestors, when Walter himself had forgotten it years since. The Duke had been quiet a moment, the way he was quiet before he said true things, and then told her that it was the moment he had understood she had built something whole and good and entirely without him, that the boy who handed him that horse had been made a person, a happy one, by her alone, in his absence and despite it, and that he had known, holding it, that he would not be allowed simply to step into a life already complete, but would have to earn the right to be led into it. He kept the horse, he said, to remember that nothing about them had ever been owed to him, that it had all been a gift from a woman who owed him nothing, and that a man who forgot such a thing did not deserve to keep it. Rowena had not told him, then or since, that she had understood in the same instant exactly what the giving of the horse had meant, and had let her son give it, and had known, watching the man's face, that she was going to be able to do the thing she had thought 2 years before, in a cold conservatory, she would never be able to do again, to mean a forgiveness rather than perform one. She kept that to herself. A marriage needs a few true things held quietly in reserve, the way a careful woman keeps a little put by against a hard winter, and Rowena Bramwell, who had survived 1 hard winter on exactly such reserves, had not lost the habit and never did. There is a particular freedom that comes only to the people who were not waited for, given up for lost, run from, left in the cold without a forwarding address, and who are then found anyway, not hunted down and reclaimed, but come upon by accident in a crowded room, and chosen and asked and allowed to say their conditions, and believed. That she said yes was the bravest thing Rowena ever did, braver than leaving. Leaving had asked only her pride, and staying asked her whole guarded heart. But she had always been the steady one, always able, in the end, to do the difficult, honest thing. It was the truest thing about her, and it was the thing he had married. These stories are for everyone who held their composure in the cold and walked out into the dark with 1 small case and no forwarding address, who built a whole good life out of nothing but their own competence and refused to be ashamed of the building, who learned that being found is not the same as being caught, and that the only love worth keeping is the kind that knocks and waits and asks and accepts the conditions and is grateful. They arrive here, like a face found across a crowded room by someone who had long since stopped looking, whenever they are ready.